Your grace. In my heart, I think I understand what you're saying, but unfortunately, the rational part of my mind was trained in a certain way that makes it difficult for me to understand how, if the Old Testament priesthood is fulfilled in Christ, how, and then we talk about the priesthood, you know, the kingdom of priests, right? So that the entire Christian people, in a sense, are priests. And yet, in a sense, there are priests. And there is a distinction between priests and people. But that's not very clear, especially in the New Testament. And I would like for you maybe to talk about that a little bit, please.
This I cover in the next lecture, or the next session. Very true what you are saying. The point that we need to remember here is that the origin of the priesthood is the will and the action of God, who called Aaron by name and his sons, as it's recorded in Exodus. So what we are talking essentially here is the priesthood established by God. The priesthood in the New Testament, you are correct, is covered in another way, but we will discuss that in more detail so we don't repeat. You'll excuse me for drinking the coffee. I never appreciated in any conference, any lectures or with audience people drinking coffee while a speaker is up there. I always thought that was rather disrespectful, but that was my personal quirk. But now I didn't have a chance to get the coffee during the break. So you're... Other discussions, or just... I think this should be open. I think we should just be sharing. It isn't an issue of questions and answers only, but...
Well, first of all, Your Grace.
Mm-hmm. You know, like everyone comes to the microphone here to help His Grace know you in person. Mm-hmm. So say your name, where you serve, it takes.
Okay. Father Michael LaFoon, St. Mark Church, Irvine, California. First of all, Your Grace, forgive me, and speaking on behalf of the brethren, forgive us all. We're very used to drinking our coffee and water in this room, so sorry about that. Wondering if you want to talk about this now, if this is something also that you're going to cover later. The development of the ministry from the early church through antiquity, through the Middle Ages to now, in terms of the relative roles of the bishop and the presbyters, because it is an issue of priesthood, right? The bishop is a priest, and the presbyter is a priest. The bishop is the image of the high priest.
Yes. We talk about the development. The priesthood in the apostolic times was really those appointed by the apostles or ordained who met a certain qualification in the judgment of the apostles, who left successors in the various churches. For what purpose? For teaching. And for the conducting of the Eucharist. Then the bishops, who were appointed by the apostles, called to have helpers. These are the priests, who shared in the responsibilities of the preaching and of the liturgical service. It's not until much later that there is a more formal organization of the church, after, of course, Constantine the Great. Then the church found the need to organize. And how did it organize itself for the ministry? It followed, essentially, the government, the geographical limits of creating dioceses and metropolises and so on. And Constantine is responsible, really, for, there are different interpretations to that. We can take it as we want. And one does not, for me, exclude the other, is the one who really called the Council of Bishops, because he wanted the business of this heresy of Arius to be resolved. And some would say, well, he did this because he was interested in the unity of the church. Others would say he was politically motivated because he wanted the unity of the empire. To me, it doesn't make any difference. Both are equally valid. And when you do have the unity of the empire, which is not unrecognized, even in the economy of God, in the coming of Christ. You remember the one of the hymns of the hours of the Christmas feast, the Nativity feast, speaks about when there was one empire. When Augustine was the reigning empire, it was then that the polytheism was eliminated and monotheism, the emergence, the coming of Christ. And here is the revelation of God's truth. Now, if we're talking about how the position of the bishop has developed, we think oftentimes in terms of the bishop and the priest along the duties of administration and organization. But in early times, that was not the pressing issue. This developed much later. And the bishop as the icon of Christ and the priest as his collaborators is following in Christ and his disciples. And the apostles, as they preached, then we see from Paul and all the others who organized the communities or called to, well, what was the organization? Come together to hear the apostle of the Lord. Peter has come. Let's go and hear what he has to say. Let's hear what he is telling us and teaching us about Jesus. They certainly weren't thinking of him as the vicar of Christ on earth seated in Rome. We could never accept that kind of an explanation. That's a much later developments, and we're still dealing with that today. But the central role, of course, is the bishop as the high priest who serves the liturgy and becomes the center of the Eucharistic community, who is the teacher, as Christ was the teacher, and then finally as the organizer, the administrator, the king. So here we center around him. For what purpose? for purpose of organization. And being human beings, we need organization. We need to define areas of responsibility and authority. And we're still grappling with that. You grapple with it in your parish. Who decides? Who has the authority? And I think... Are you recording this? Let me go on record then. Maybe I'll temper it a little bit, but let me go on record. I really think the mode of governing the parishes in America needs to change. I'm not sure what happens in your diocese or in the Antiochian Archdiocese, but from what I see, people being elected, campaigning, to be on the parish council, and to say, I now have the authority of the parish council, and unfortunately, many times they are correct, because that's what the Constitution or the bylaws says. What is the status of the priest? By virtue and by dignity of his being the priest in the actual administration of the church. So I think this needs to be looked at from the, let's say, the Orthodox ethos of really giving to the priest the dignity that is his from the theological perspective, not from the administrative. And the theological is always based on the biblical, the evangelical. Do you want to be there signing checks? Or do you want to be there directing the ministries? But in directing the ministries, whoever the check signer is not going to give you a hard time about it. But says, this is responsibly what the priest and perhaps his advisors, if you have ministers of ministries, I think we need to kind of clarify that a little bit. If we have youth workers, to dignify that with a title that's appropriate, with authority and with responsibility, and of course with accountability. In my estimation, that would belong to the priest on the local level. And the priest then is responsible to the bishop. And the bishop, what is he? He's the episkopos, the overseer. And being the dean of the Theological Academy in Albania, when we would meet with the faculty, they would say, oh, your grace, whatever you decide, whatever you want, whatever you decide. And I said, I know it's whatever I decide. I know I am the deciding factor. But before I decide, I want to hear what you think and why. Because this is a problem that affects all of us in this academy. You as faculty, students, staff people, and myself as the director. Because I'm responsible to God and to the Archbishop. So before we make a decision, before I make the decision, if you want to put it that way, yes, I will decide. But before I do, I want to hear what you have to say and what your thoughts are and why. And that changed the atmosphere totally and completely. Because then I said, everybody's welcome. And certain things I would put up to a vote. And I would let them vote. And I remember on one particular issue, I said, I totally and completely don't agree with his vote. My opinion is totally contrary to what you've decided, but I'll accept it because you voted it and you're a faculty and you have responsibility. And my dear brothers and sisters, because we had women there, you are responsible for this decision. When things start going south, remember that it was your vote that put it in this way. And of course, we can come back and revisit the issue. And so by the participation, and I think Sometimes we look at the bishop as the ultimate and authority who just decides by what? By his, well, that's how it might be communicated, but by capriccio, as we say? We just feel like doing it this way and that's the way it is? And I think a lot of times that's conveyed. And the other thing is, oh, you know, what do you want, bishop? What do you want, bishop? What do you want, bishop? Well, wait a minute now. Here, let's... Certain essential issues are decided by the bishop. There's no question about it. And he decides because his view is a lot broader than ours. That's why he's called the episcopos. He's the overseer. The higher you go up on the building, the more you can see. Go to the roof, and you see the whole complex. Sit down here, and you can't see very far, maybe across the courtyard, and that's about it. But you don't have the full picture. And this is what the bishop can do. And his picture is always consistent with the teaching, the doctrine, the practice, the canons of the church, which are the guides. But the doctrines are absolute and immutable. Did I answer your question, or did I waltz around too much?
Mostly. Sayyidina, Father Timothy, St. Michael, Antiochian Orthodox Church in Van Nuys, here in the valley. I want to press this issue further. We live in a country that believes in separation of church and state. Yet in many ways there is this fallacy over this, whereas the church often finds itself at the mercy of civil law. How are we then wisely, and how can we be guided by you, our bishops, to protect ourselves from all kinds of liabilities? I don't want to get specific, maybe you can, in helping us with this.
Well, this is a kind of principle that we have, separation of church and state, and many times that comes as a blessing that we are separated from the state. Should the church and should the people of the church, bishops or clergy or lay people, be involved in influencing or directing laws and legislation? On my account, I would say yes. But what is our message? Our message must be based on the gospel and our faith. We must be motivated to speak with clarity about moral issues, social issues, perhaps even issues of economic justice. Those things that touch the human being in his relationship to God and to one another, to the society in which he lives. Let me illustrate that by an experience that I had when I was in Massachusetts at the Massachusetts Commission on Christian Unity. So one day we were going to have our meeting and we said we'll have someone come, expert, who is going to present some issues, and then we're going to have kind of an exchange of ideas. So this, I think he was a sociologist, said, let me create some issues, some problems for you, and see how the discussion goes. So he talked about a custodian in a state hospital. for the mentally ill. How this man took advantage of a woman inmate and impregnated her. Now, what do you have to say about this problem? Well, then they started. There's a legal problem here. Yes. Is the child legitimate? Is he illegitimate? What name would the child have? Look at all the legal problems created here. Well, all right. The legal community would have to answer this. Now, who's going to pay for this? Who's going to raise this child? Here are the social problems. Here are the economic problems. Who's going to pay for it? This is the award of the state. Is some relative responsible? Now, there's also the issue of the woman. What's her condition? And what rights does she have, if she has any rights? Well, this just went on and on and on. So finally, in despair, actually, I said, fine. We have talked about the economic dimension, we've talked about the social, we've talked about the educational, we've talked about the legal, we've talked about the medical. Should she have an abortion? We've talked about all these aspects of this problem. And we have said these resolutions and solutions belong to other disciplines, of which we are none capable of speaking. Then for God's sake, I said, where is the ethical issue here? Who will raise their voice for the immorality of that custodian who violated this woman? Is he guilty before the law of God? Has he betrayed the trust, the public trust put into him to care for the well-keeping and upkeep of those facilities where the mentally ill live? Who is going to speak about this if not the church? For me, this is what we should be talking about. Thank you very much. It's time for lunch. Never addressed it. Never addressed it. And for me, these are the issues that we have to speak about. These are the things that we have to say. That we are bound by the moral law and the ethical teachings of our Savior, and to voice them and to raise them, even at the cost of being politically incorrect. But we do compromise. We don't want to say things because it might offend some government person or some whoever it is. And we're not always sure. This has been our problem in the standing conference, somewhat, not completely, but somewhat. We're very slow there. We're very slow in the conference. My suggestion has been that as a standing conference, we need to issue, at the risk of being contrary to what our name says, canonical, so we don't want to be uncanonical. I said, let's not call it an encyclical, because that has a little more ecclesiastical power. The bishop or the synod issues encyclicals. Let's just call them a teaching paper. And when issues come up, which we have discussed, suicide, for example, we've issued a statement on suicide. Well, why do we need these things? Because we need to clarify and state in contemporary language the same old teaching of the church. Or abortion. But I get frustrated when people say, or clergy say, well, what is the Orthodox, what does the Orthodox have to say about abortion? That answer's been, that question's been answered 17, 18 hundred years ago. It's murder. We don't need to be told or say, what does the church say about this? We know. But we need to articulate again in our contemporary language and for our contemporary society what the age-old teaching of the Christian faith is. And I don't think we should shy away from it. I think we should do it. And it's helpful because when the paper calls up and says, oh, this big case of somebody was issue of abortion, you know, Father, what do you say, or what does your church say? I say, I'll talk to you in 15 minutes. You pull out the statement of the SCOBA, you reread it, you rework it in your mind, and then you tell them. And you say, as the bishops, the Standing Conference of Bishops, has said in their encyclical of, well, a year ago or 2 years ago, it's okay, it's not that old. Here's what they say. This is the position. This is how we are to. And embellish that with your own reaction to whatever is there. Now, who does this? The Catholics do it. We're in a Catholic institution. I have never heard a Catholic presentation by any theologian or priest, even on a superficial level, that doesn't quote some recent letter of the Pope, the papal encyclical on whatever it is, and they give us the Latin terminology. It's at their fingertips. They have it all the time, and they never veer from it. So they have something to refer to. And I think we need to create, collectively and separately, these kinds of statements, which can help us, the priests, to communicate not only to the press, but also to our own people, what we say. We write encyclicals and they're never read. You're going to have one Sunday on Cheese Fair Sunday for missions. Are you going to read it? I don't know. But they're written and they're there. And there's a one voice for Orthodoxy speaking on this issue of missions, asking for support. But we can go beyond that. We can apply that to our scriptural teachings as well and to our homilies by saying, as the encyclical relates, this is what we should be doing. It's not always bent for an appeal. There's an appeal there, yes. But there's also the rationale, the theological rationale, the religious rationale as to why we are making this appeal. I don't think we should be hesitant or ashamed to quote that. And I don't think we should be hesitant to also convey these thoughts and these expressions to our own bishops. If we can write it down in as we read things in the newspaper or articles or so on, and some kind of response that we begin to build up. I've read some very good things written by parish priests on various social issues. And sometimes they're extreme, but they're also defended. And there's something to be said about that kind of a statement. And that's all right. You know, we have people say, this is the Orthodox point of view. Who said so? You said so. Because you want to say, this is what the Orthodox say. I like that story of Metropolitan Callistos. Maybe you have heard him tell it. At some conference, there was some issue being discussed, and the moderator, who was not Orthodox, said, perhaps you would like to give the Orthodox point of view. So some Orthodox got up and volunteered and said what he had to say. And when he finished, another one popped up and said, well, you know, this is okay, but... And then he went on to illustrate his point. And someone went on to a third point and a fourth point. And then finally, the Anglican chairman said, well, perhaps the Orthodox have not agreed on a position. To which, of course, all the Orthodox stood up and said, oh, yes, we have. So, you got up, that means I should stop.
No. No, Father David Hovig from St. Andrew in Arlington. I actually want to affirm you. Really, this is fantastic, and I'm hearing it with my own ears, an Orthodox hierarch defending the pro-life position. And my question, I think, is piggybacking on what you've said. How do we get the bishops to come out with a collective witness for this? You know, a few weeks ago, the clergy in the Northwest were on the state capitol of Washington. There were 8,000 people there. It's the largest gathering they've ever had. Probably about 6,000 of those people were Roman Catholics. There were about 30 Orthodox. And, you know, it's embarrassing. And we, of all churches, you know, the church, should have a clear witness about life. And so I'm asking, I think both of you really, how do we come to a place where SCOBA makes an annual statement where this is clear, and where the priests are encouraged on Sanctity of Human Life Sunday to really affirm life? So thank you for what you've said so far. And
well, I don't know if we need to do that every year. I don't know if we need to do that every year. But there are possibilities for these things to be, considering the year, the Sunday of what do you say, affirming life or whatever. I think that certainly could be done. We send encyclicals for many different things as a standing conference. We just had two of them, one for the network, the radio ministry, another for the Cheese Fair, the missions. We do something for the Sunday of Orthodoxy. We do something for other events. But to integrate this into really what parishes are doing or can do is good, but also to have these kind of teaching statements so that the idea is, as we did on the... suicides. What do we do with the suicide? And there was a lot of give and take on that. Do we do it? Do we? How do we approach that issue? And should we do services? Should we do a memorial? Should we do a trisagion? What can be done? Well, this illustrates that. But we do broach that subject and say, well, yes, but then, of course, the disclaimer, there always is one, with the blessing and permission of the bishop. So you need to call the bishop and say, these are the circumstances. What do you think? What can we do here, pastorally, for this family that suffered a suicide? And what do we go in and do the judgmental thing about it? Well, we really don't know the condition of that soul when he or she decides to take her life. And we don't know the condition of that soul while that process is going on. When we were having this discussion in the standing conference, Archbishop Demetrius told the story of a very pious, religious man who lost an offspring by suicide, jumping from a high building. And the man was broken for years, living with this reality that his child had committed suicide. What happened to his soul? And he sought answers repeatedly in very different places until he met an elder. And he tearfully explained to him his anguish at the loss of his child and at the judgment of that human soul as a father, weeping for his child. And the elder said, "We do not know. What was he thinking on that drop from the high place to his death? Could he have repented? Could he have asked for God's mercy and forgiveness as he is in the act of taking his own life? We do not know." And the man found some solace in this answer. So what do? We pray. One time we did a funeral with your cubaro, who was our second priest in Las Vegas. And after we finished the funeral, he came to me and said, "How well did you know the deceased?" "Well, I don't know." I said, "I know who he is. But I mean, how well did you really know him in his soul?" "Well, I don't think I knew him very well at all," I said. "Then how did you say he's in God's kingdom?" I said, "I didn't say he's in God's kingdom. But we're praying that he's there." Isn't that what the hymns say? With the righteous repose the soul of this servant. Is he with the righteous? I don't know. But I'm praying that God will put him there in his infinite mercy and compassion. Just let's not be judgmental. I'm not willing to risk that. And you've seen it too, and you've heard it too. You go to minister to a dying person and say, "Yes." "Well," he said to me, "I guess the time has come for me to ask for forgiveness. God, forgive me for all my sins and for my mistakes." The man's dying, and he's asking for forgiveness. What I'm going to say to him? How many times did you cheat at the poker table? How many times did you defraud or betray your wife? What am I going to do? Start to have the 20 questions? No. He repented. For me, that was a repentance. Did the thief say more on the cross? "Remember me, Lord, in your kingdom." And we celebrate that and say, that's the first citizen of God's kingdom. First one to make it. So we have to be careful about our judgments. I don't think we should be reckless. But we need to be careful about that. And to bring the balance between our responsibility and accountability. We heard it the last weekend in the scripture readings from Luke and from Matthew. But we also need to remember God's mercy and compassion. in Albania, one of the priests came to me and said, well, I got a call. He was the chaplain at the seminary. And he said, somebody called and said their father was dying and they wanted me to go. Well, I said, did you go? He said, no. I said, why? Because he was a Muslim. And I said, the man who was dying was Muslim? Yes. And his son, who is also a Muslim, or maybe not, came to you? Yes. And you didn't go? He said, no. You did not do well, I said. He said, Bishop, are you telling me that I should have gone? Absolutely, I said, you should have gone. Because for the dying man and for his son, you are a representative of God. You have access to God. And right now, I'm at my wit's end, and I need a religious person to come and to do something, to say something. You should have gone. I never thought of it that way, he said. I said, think of it. Because you don't know that man's faith, how strong it is or how weak it is. But he wanted you to come, and you could have gone and found some words of prayer. And will you witness to Christ? Yes. Because you know I'm a Christian. And if you're going to ask me in the public arena to go and say prayers at the city council meeting or the Board of Education and say, oh, by the way, don't mention Christ. And I tell them, get somebody else. Because I have no other Lord. And if I can't mention my Savior's name in my prayer, then I don't offer the prayer. You're in worse state than I thought. And we allow non-Christians to intimidate us and to force us into these situations where we, like Peter, deny Jesus. You heard it in the gospel this morning. Personally, I refuse to do that. I find that very offensive. If we are in a state of separation of church and state, then I stand on my religious conviction. And if I have to listen to the Native American Indian invoke God, the Son, and Mother Earth, then you can hear the name of the creator of that Father, Son, and Mother Earth. Because God is the God of creation. And I would insist on these things. Or I am unavailable for the prayer, the service, the occasion of that prayer. No, thank you, that's enough.
Your Grace, I'm Father Paul Baba from West Sacramento Holy Virgin Mary Church. My question to you is, with all the SCOBA activity you've been involved with and all the jurisdictions that are here in America, don't you believe, in your opinion on this, that it'd be a great impact of missionary outreach to all of America, the unconverted American people, to have a TV show instead of these little cable networks, or of course we have the radio outreach, but an actual TV show like 700 Club or like the Roman Catholics have, celebrating Mass, we could have liturgy. I have Roman Catholics that would come into my church visiting and they say, oh, we can't stand the Roman Catholic priests. They protest about this and that. They get so angry. And the Orthodox approach is we don't do that. We are humble in our approach and we share our faith and love. And I feel that our liturgy to be seen on TV, our Vesper services and even conversations that you're having with us for the world to hear, I believe that'll capture them. Jesus was on the Mount of Beatitudes and the whole world saw him. The apostles on Pentecost, the whole world was seeing them, 5,000. I know that they wanted to be seen. Shouldn't we in this modern day try to show ourselves more in that way in order to capture souls, because there's so much negativity with abortion, pro-life, and all that, homosexuality and marriages and all these things. What's our counter approach? Would this be a good approach, Your Grace? TV. And one last thing, we have probably not all the money in the world like 700 Club, but we do have our jurisdictions to join in maybe this worthy cause. And individuals like, you know, don't laugh, but like a Tom Hanks and other people out there that have money, even though I don't believe he betrays so much of what is good, but can we gather something to do something like this?
I discern two parts to your question and comments. I will answer the second part first, because it's easy. Yes. Whatever can be done, and in whatever way it can be done, to project the Orthodox faith on a national television program or an Orthodox studio, television studio. The Catholics have their own, as you say, and others. They have the whole setup themselves. I definitely think that's important. And I would add to that the creation of Orthodox-inspired literature. We haven't had too much since Dostoevsky, have we? Where the Orthodox ethos and life is portrayed through literature. I think this is good. There are some Greeks that have done it, but it's in the Greek language. They haven't all been translated yet. So I think literature could be used. I think the media could be used. I would certainly feel that that's a good thing. Now, to come back to how do we do that? Skoba has been in existence for a long time, 50 years, at least in this phase of its existence. And I remember discussing at low tide of Skoba with Father Paul Schneller, who is the epitome of churchmanship as a diplomat. Do you agree? Or maybe you don't agree. But I have seen him operate in very tense situations. And Father Paul always had the ability to bring people around and to smooth over the rough edges. And believe you me, there were a lot of them, and they were pretty sharp. But I said there was a Schnerlin principle at work in Skoba. And I would say, Father Paul, and he would say, Elia, Skoba is all we got. Whether it's good or bad, whether we're flying high or flying low, it's all we got. So, Jackson said, the union, it must be preserved. So Skoba is all we got, and that's what we're going to have to work with. Now, what has Skoba done? Not a great deal, you might say. But Skoba has created the atmosphere where things can get done. Look at the OCMC. Look at the IOCC. Look at all this alphabet soup that we got, of all these commissions and organizations, various kinds, that are pulling in Orthodox on the Orthodox principle of participating to the extent that you want to participate, not legislated, because we don't have the stormtroops to send in and say, you have to be there. Everything is on a voluntary basis. How many things are going on a pan-Orthodox level that have been blessed or sanctioned or supported or sponsored in one way or to one degree or another by the SCOBA? This is an achievement. This is an achievement. Despite the very grueling and fundamental differences that have evolved over the years. Despite the personalities of the leadership of the various jurisdictions, who are an expression and an extension of who they are in the way that they direct their church or their jurisdiction. So we want to talk about working together. We're not there yet. We are not there yet. We are not mature. And I defy anybody to tell me differently. What do you mean we're not mature? We got schools, we got priests, we got indigenous clergy, we got how many parishes here and there? Yes. But are we together? Bishop Jovis is going to be there, I'm not going. That's what was significant about the Pan-Orthodox retreat for the clergy. And I told them in front of the four bishops who were responsible for it. This is daring. Its time has come, but passed. Subdeacon Michael was sharing with me some information before. I said, well, all the bishops are our bishops. What do I say? Bishop Joseph is not my bishop. We've heard priests say that. What do you mean? Is he in a different church and you're in a different church? You all say Orthodox Church. You all have the same creed. You all have the same beliefs. But you have different bishops. You see, we've got to make adjustments up here. How do we think and how do we conceive this? Yes, for organization, Bishop Joseph has his diocese and has his administrative responsibilities. But we are one church in belief. And we got to begin to think in that category. And we have to be able to build the trust among ourselves and among our leadership and among those who advise the SCOBA hierarchs, because they are the primates of their diocese, of their jurisdictions, to trust and to work with one another. Father Schnerler has contributed immensely to this, and others have as well, I must say. And their temperament and their objectivity has helped a lot to make the kind of progress that we have made. But this is what we have to pray for, and we have to work for. And we have to study and build for it. And then we will have the finances. Because when people see the unity and the message of the unity, and when they see brothers embracing each other with sincerity, when we see them working together, then people will respond in like fashion. I say we're not mature enough yet, but we're working on it. A work in progress to mature and to develop the real sense of brotherhood and trust among the hierarchs, among the clergy. We'll have a bishop's assembly again, because this is mandated by the Pan-Orthodox Conference in Shambhazi in June. I was there as a representative of the Church of Albania, the only American there. And the decision was to create episcopal assemblies in various geographical areas. This is the decision, and this is what's being implemented. And here are the beginnings which will be supported for the creation of more cooperation, of integration, and ultimately of the kind of union that we often speak about. The kind of union that Metropolitan Philip has called for. But nobody yet has given us the formula, which is realistic and practical in dealing with the reality of the church in America right now. We say, theoretically, this is what we need, but practically, how do we get there?
Your Grace, I'm Father George from Torrance, California. I would like to take issue with what you said, and I say this with a great deal of humility, and I don't want it to come across as being insulting, but I think I think the maturity is there. I think that the problem comes from basically the hierarchs overseas that are making the decisions, that are directing things down the line in the church, who are telling us that we're not mature, that we're not ready. If they know that we're not mature and we're not ready, what steps are they taking to educate us, to push us in this direction? I think some of them, I'm not going to name any names, but I think some of them encourage the immaturity, they encourage the division. Their priority is the ethnic divisions. They emphasize it. They preach on it. They don't tell us. They don't come into the parishes at the local level or whatnot and say, you need to get along with these people. Instead, they say, oh, well, no, this is good, and this is who we are. And they don't tell us, you're not in the old country anymore. You're in a new country. You need to live in that environment. You need to get along with these people. Instead, I think that we get played off of each other here. And that other agendas get projected into our country. And so we're pawns. If we're not mature, if we're not ready, whose fault is that? It's the people who take responsibility, who take leadership, who make the claims. If somebody wants to make claims that they're in control of this country, that they need to be making the decisions, and that they need to take responsibility for the faults. If things go chaotic in my parish, I can't blame the people. When the bishop calls, he calls me. Why? Because he put me in charge. He said, these are your people. You fix it. We always get blamed for our own problems. Who is it that is in charge? That's my feeling. I may be very wrong on this. I may have it all completely wrong. But I think that it's, if we're going to come up with solutions here, that we need the hierarchy to be on the same, to really take the lead on it and say they're going to fix it. Not that they're going to blame us for the problems and then not give us a solution. So forgive me.
Why should I forgive you? What is there so offensive to what you said? Stay there if you want to. Because You challenge me, I'll challenge you right back. I want you to state and analyze to whatever extent you feel it's necessary to prove your point, or to substantiate, not prove it, but to support it, that we are mature as a church in America. What do you say qualifies us as a mature church?
In a word, does the ministry of any one of these priests here, is, or let's just say in general, do we labor less than anyone else in the world? Do we have less God? Do we share less of the Holy Spirit? Do the priests in the old country, or the bishops in the old country, do they labor any harder?
My dear Father George, you are showing your immaturity by projecting everything abroad. If we are mature, then we take what you have said. We are responsible. You already said that. I'm responsible in my parish. If things go wrong, I got to look at myself. I got to look at my people, and I have to call the bishop for help. And he's going to ask me what's going on. That's maturity. Saying, I am responsible. I am responsible for the decision. If I make a good decision, I got good results. If I make bad decisions, I got bad results. And I am mature because I take responsibility for this. And not only I, in my priesthood and in my leadership role in the parish, but also together with the parishioners, and especially those who are called to be on the parish council, to direct the life and to set the tone of the parish. Are we on the same level? If we are, then we are growing. Our maturity is beginning to show. If we are not, then we are immature because we don't have the same agenda. I agree. I say we are not mature because we haven't come to that level of trusting one another. Because we need to grow in our own sense of unity among the brethren, even within one jurisdiction or within one diocese. I never participated in that, so I don't know. I don't know, but I've heard some terrible horror stories of how a priest undercuts the position of another priest in a parish because he wants to get that parish, or for whatever reason, whatever the devil prompts him to do. He's willing to do that at the expense of his brother priest. So we're talking about maturity. Do you meet your budget? Is stewardship where it should be for the support of the church? Most dioceses, most archdioceses, most everybody's operating at a deficit, and a lot of parishes aren't meeting the bill either. Well, it's the economic situation, exactly. So when the economic situation, the first one to suffer is the church. I used to give $1,000, now I'm going to give $500. But I've heard parishioners say, we're going through tough times, but I'm not cutting my stewardship. Because they trust in the Lord that they're going to survive. Now, talking about the foreign churches or the churches abroad. The churches, by and large here, were formed by the immigrants. But we're beyond that, you're going to say, and I agree. We are second, third, fourth, fifth generation. And we are people who have no ties with any church of the historical churches abroad. Americans who are a product totally and completely of the American society and culture. Is there no place in Orthodoxy for them? Perish the thought. Of course there is. Of course there is, from my point of view. But we have a structure in the church, which includes those churches abroad. And do they really govern here? I don't know. I cannot say that with a certainty. I can tell you what I know from titles. In your case, it's called the self-governing. They wanted to go with autonomous, but it's called self-governing because autonomous has another meaning. Well, what means self-governing? You decide for yourselves. You have the bishops that decide what is within their realm of the collegiality of the church and the structure that is applicable here to decide those issues which are to be decided. From what point of view? From the point of view of the episkopos, the overseer, who sees the whole picture. There are extenuating circumstances in every case. Why are mother churches, patriarchates and autocephalous churches, interested in people of their particular ethnic background in the United States? There are vested interests there. Let's admit it. Yes. There can be revenue. There can be influence. There can be resources that can be to the advantage and to the use and support of the mother church, wherever that church may be. So we want to have, or they want to have, a good relation here. And we also draw from that relationship to our advantage, to our needs. And advantage is not a bad word. I don't want to say that, well, I'm exploiting you, or they're exploiting us. Advantage means a definite support and positive in the relationship between the two, the mother churches and the jurisdictions in America. I cannot, from my own experience, I say this, I cannot incorporate into my thinking, that's when I say accept, this is what I mean, that mother churches have a negative, dominant feeling about the people of their particular background or jurisdiction that are outside. There's a genuine and legitimate concern. I don't see it as being indifferent, and I don't see it as being hostile. From my point of view, I have participated in Pan-Orthodox. I know bishops in every church, all the patriarchates and all of the autocephalous churches, because of my participation, not through America, but through the Church of Albania, where I've been asked by the Archbishop to represent the Church of Albania as an autocephalous church. And I can tell you, the spirit and the feeling among those people that come together, theologians, lay people, bishops, priests, deacons, when they come together, there is a genuine spirit of love and cooperation and working together to give the witness of the Orthodox Church, be it in dialogue with the Roman Catholics, the Anglicans, the Reformed, or be it to discuss pan-Orthodox issues, as was the issue of the diaspora in Geneva in June, where I was. You see an entire dynamic, different dynamic at work. And you know why? Because everybody knows everybody else's place, including his own. There's no competition there. Albania is the 13th autocephalous church of 14. So we're at the end of the table on the right side. Number 14 is opposite, the Czech and Slovak church. They're number 14. So everybody, you go stand at the altar, everybody knows his place. You have the protos from the ecumenical patriarchate, and then everybody else next. And if the protos isn't there, the metropolitan of the Church of Alexandria presides. And if he's not there, Antioch. And I have participated in liturgies where the chief celebrant, the first, has been Archbishop Pavlos from Antioch. And the others take their places around, the Serb, the Bulgarian, the Russian, the Albanian, whoever they are, we take our place. No problem in the liturgy. And everybody say his own language. Whatever language he has, say. Nobody says, say it this way, say it that way. Up to you. Up to you. So there is the unity of the church, evident and visible in these pan-Orthodox conferences or inter-Orthodox. And there I see a maturity. And there I see my point of view, from my point of view, what I see. And that's what I give witness to. As I see, I judge, and my judgment is just. Because I have experienced it. A respect and a concern for America and for the diaspora, let's call it. Yeah, we get offended by the term diaspora. Heaven's sakes, why? Do you want to be called barbarians? That's what the canon says, for the barbarian lands. No. We are a diaspora, but not in the Jewish sense. The Jews use that term to think of those who had left Israel or Palestine and were someday perhaps going to go back. And this is the Jewish diaspora. They use the Greek word, but it has that meaning also. But that's not how we mean it. I'm not going to go back to Albania. I was born here. Do I love Albania? It's the land of my father and my mother. I had the opportunity to go. Yes, I have relatives there. And I serve there because there was a need. But what does that have to do with my religious life here? There is the connect, yes. But I don't see them making decisions for me here or for you. I see them giving us direction and guidance, and heaven forbid, to slap us on the wrist if we need it. And let's not be so arrogant that sometimes we don't need a slap on the wrist. Because we are influenced by a very, very powerful secular society. There was in Jerusalem, Arabs, for Epiphany. And we go to the monastery of St. John the Baptist, and then we process to go to the Jordan River where they throw the cross, the patriarch. And they do this on the 5th. Not the 6th, but the 5th. It fell on a Sunday. And that year, there must have been about 35 American priests, mostly Greeks. and we're going. And then we look, and here come these school buses. Without exaggeration, 50. And at the head of the bus is a priest. And the priest steps down, and out come 50, 60 faithful. Some carrying children, some holding them on their lap, mothers, fathers, old men, old women, youngsters, teenagers. Here they are coming. And we're walking to the River Jordan. And the patriarch is at the end of the line with the diplomats and the hierarchs and so on. And then the people. And some priest said, "Shame." I said, "About what? I'm in prayer." He's saying, "Shame. What do you find so shameful, brother?" He said, "Look at this road. It's dusty. It's not paved. Shouldn't it have been paved for us to go to the River Jordan?" I said, "The shame is on you, brother, because you're getting a little dust on your shoes, on your American shoes. Look behind you what you have. Hundreds of Arabs, Orthodox, Palestinians from Israel, who have been up since 4 o'clock this morning to take that bus ride to come here and fasting because they want to drink water from the River Jordan. And you're complaining about a little bit of dust on your shoes? Shame on you," I said. "And you don't think of your parishioners who have paved roads and can walk to church or come in their shiny cars, and they come at the liturgy when we're saying the Our Father. And you're criticizing the roadway, and you don't see the fervor of these people who are up from dawn to make it here, to see their patriarch, and to hear the hymns, and to drink water from the Jordan. Your priorities are all out of kilter. You are wrong." He said, "I never thought of it that way." I said, "If you did, you wouldn't have said what you said and complain about this. Think of the exaltation of being at the place where our Lord was baptized, and you're concerned about dust on your shoes. Come on." And you see expressions of faith. And then we return to the monastery. And the patriarchate had provided for us. And then one of the deacons came and said reverently, "Fathers, when you have finished, would you please vacate these places? Because there are other people, the people from the buses, who want to come and sit down at these tables and on these chairs so that they can take some nourishment. And we are providing," what are we providing? "Bread and fruit and nuts and vegetables because it's a fast day." And the people came with reverence and with piety to participate even in the repast after the blessing. I have seen the sacrifices of people who have nothing. This is maturity in faith, without complaining. I have seen them in Albania. Tuesday of Bright Week, there's a monastery, abandoned one, of Saint Paraskevi. Tradition is to go on Tuesday of Bright Week, do the liturgy there. "Bishop, you're going to come?" "Absolutely," I said, "we'll go there." Raining, like today. We're driving with my chauffeur 8 o'clock in the morning to get to the church. And there are hundreds walking on the same dirt, muddy road to get to the church of St. Paraskevi. And I looked, and there were young people, teenagers. I said, is there no school today? Yes, there is school. Well, I said, look at all these young people. Oh, he said, they're going to St. Paraskevi. They are? Yes. It's the feast day of St. Paraskevi. And they got to come there to light their candle, to stay in the altar, to venerate to stay in the church, to venerate the icon, to spend whatever time they're able, and to vacate because others want to come in. And here they are all around the church with their blankets or with their lunches or whatever they have, sitting down and receiving the blessing of that holy place. We don't see too much of that in the United States, I'm afraid, yet. We don't. But people in Europe, the Middle East, they have this. Because their grandmothers and grandfathers, because their priests and their monks and their mothers and fathers have talked to them about this. And they wait with anticipation for these feast days. They abandon their business. They abandon their school because it's the feast day of St. Paraskevi or St. John or St. whatever it is. And these are local celebrations and they will go. Do they stay in church piously and make reverences? And no, they don't. Do they know anything about St. Paraskevi? Probably not. But they know that this is a holy place where Christians go and Muslims go and atheists go and unbelievers go, and where people go to find some solace because they know it is a holy place. And we, in our frailty, try to give it the dignity that is deserving of God's presence. And let people do as they will, to light a candle, to say a prayer, to venerate an icon or the icon. Is it mechanical? Perhaps. Is it a show? Maybe. But for me, this is all we have. This is all they have. And God will bless that because He knows the hearts of each. So we talk about religious maturity. This is where it comes. The bishops will do as God will inspire them to do. We haven't made fundamental decisions yet, as far as I'm concerned. We have rivalries. We have betrayals. We have disrespect. Yes, in high places. I'm one of them, so I can say it. This grieves us, but it grieves the Lord more when we as brothers do not find the way to love and to give the witness that the world needs to have, and our people as well. But that you see, I see this with you, the beautiful things that go on. When you see your fellow priests and you kiss each other's hand, and the people see this, or we embrace one another. This is the expression of the love of that brotherhood that we talked about earlier, which transcends everything else, even because I don't like the way you're wearing your beard. Or I think your robe is too short. Or whatever. Look beyond those things and say, this is my brother. And in his face I see the Lord, my maker and my master. And this is our challenge. We're way beyond the time of questions and answers, but what time is it? Right. You want a break now?
Father George, it's not about maturity or immaturity. It is about we don't have enough relationship with the mother churches. So we lack something. We lack something. So that's why those who are visiting the old country, the mother churches, they get a better idea when they go there. That you feel the sonship of the mother church when you go there. But because of the distance, because of other political reasons, so that's why we don't have the strong ties with the mother churches. But still, we are spiritually very connected. Look what happened in like a year ago. And Archdeacon George was there. You correct me if I'm... We were somewhere. Many bishops were there. And one of the bishops said, stop talking about mother churches. I don't care about mother churches. I am proud of being Scottish or something like that. And he was like very serious in what he was saying. And I said to him, he is my brother bishop, and I don't have any authority over him. But, you know, I got offended by what he's saying. I said to him, sit down. If not because the mother church, you would not be Orthodox by this moment. Did I say that or not?
Correct.
We're not talking about the culture. So the mother churches, you know, are not like something a joke. There is history, there is spirituality, there is all what we have here because of the mother churches. So if over the years something wrong has happened, let us fix it now. Let us fix it. And I am very proud of those who, when in the beginning of their journey to Orthodoxy, and when we started here, you mentioned self-rule or autonomy, Your Grace. So they were afraid autonomy or self-rule or self-governing to mean like a separation from the mother church. And you, I remember, you know, most of you told me that we've been looking for a mother for many, many years. Now, after we found the mother, so we say goodbye to her. So therefore, Father George, if you like to join this pilgrimage to Syria and Lebanon, it'd be great. It'd be great. Yes.
That's. I remember the the present patriarch Ignatius, when he came to Boston. And he addressed some of these issues. And he said, I have been to your homes. I don't see icons. I don't smell incense. I see meat on Friday and Wednesday. Where is our Orthodox expression in life? Where is our ethos? Where is our Orthodox consciousness in this? We say we're Orthodox, we're Orthodox. We wave the banner real high. But where is the praxis? I don't want to say it's not done, but you and I know that there is a lot lacking here. And I see quite the opposite in the mother churches that I have been, at least in their practice. In Albania, at the academy, strict fast. No meat, no milk, no cheese, no eggs, no fish, nothing. All the 40 days of Lent or more. Wednesdays and Fridays, strict fast. And Saturday, because tomorrow you're going to receive communion. So we don't serve meat, and there is a Lenten meal on Saturday as well in anticipation of receiving communion the next day. And these are things that the students themselves do. How many? They keep the fast now in the Lent till the third hour, till the ninth hour, what you call the ninth hour. They don't eat breakfast, they don't eat lunch. And they receive communion at the pre-sanctified, and then they'll come and have their meal. Self-imposed discipline of fasting, the level of piety that we see in different places. There are exceptions, yes, I admit. But this is what we have to strive for. I can't think of too many of my parishioners who do that.
Just that, as I mentioned before, I don't see a difference between people from the old country and people who are here. You know, many, just as I have new people, new to the faith, who know nothing about the church, and I have people from the old country who know nothing about the church,
right.
And I have people from the old country who know everything about the church, I have people here who, what we lack are those institutions, like shrines and things like that.
Yes.
But the struggles are the same.
Yes.
Why this strikes my heart, years back, and I didn't have a shaggy beard, I looked just like everybody else, I guess. I was introduced to a hierarch of a certain jurisdiction that shall remain nameless to protect the guilty, as Father Paul Schnierle would say. I was introduced to the hierarch by another priest. And then he used in his language that I understand enough of to know when I'm being insulted, I was referred to as a foreigner.
Yes.
This wasn't going on in Romania. This wasn't going on in Russia. This was going on in New York City.
Right.
I was called Xenos, and they repeated it, and they laughed, and they thought it was kind of funny, interesting. Yeah. And the hierarch didn't correct the clergy. In fact, he used it as well. If I'm a foreigner in my own country, I'm a foreigner in my own church, that was my... There, as far as I'm concerned, in this room, there are no foreigners.
Yeah.
These are my brothers. The people who come to my church, no matter where they come from, they're not Xenos. They're not other. Be they Arab, be they Greek, be they Slav of whatever shade, be they American. And if there's one thing that I believe that the hierarchs need to abolish is that word. Because as long as it's still allowed to be uttered in our parishes and in whatever the language is, that we treat someone as other. Me as an American treating an Arab or a Greek as an other, but the same way. As long as we have this otherness, that for me is the ultimate immaturity. Because what it's saying is that the faith is different. Different for these people than it is for us.
It's more than immaturity. It's an offense to God. It was the Xeno who stopped to minister to the wounded man on the road to Jericho. It was the Xeno of whom the Lord asked to give him water to drink. And I would say to the hierarchy, thank you very much for numbering me among the Samaritans who were the Xeni of the time of the Lord. I consider that an honor. And this is to his own detriment that he thinks in these categories as Kseni. But you see, what are we doing? We're educating. We're in the process of educating ourselves on how to handle these situations and on other people who create the situation. We are the educator. And the Lord admonishes us to do precisely this. He was rebuffed from his own people. He was a Jew, but yet a Kseno, because he said things that they did not like. So let's not, I understand, and I understand, well, maybe I don't understand, but I've heard the offense, that how offensive this can be. But we suffer these offenses in humility and knowing that this is what we need to do. One time we were having dinner and the mom said something to the little boy and he took great offense. And he said, "That's dumb." So a little bit later, something else happened and he said, "Ah, that was great, Mom." And I said, "Not bad for a dumb mom, is it?" And he just looked at me. I didn't correct him when he called his mother dumb, but I did then, when I found the right time and the right opportunity. So we have to give witness in this way. And I understand your, I appreciate your frustration, because we have heard this in many other places, and where people have left the church because they have been offended in this way. But I remember Catherine Lingus' story. How many of you know Catherine Lingus? You know Catherine Lingus, who said she walked into the Greek church in Portland, Oregon, and Father Elias Stephanopoulos of blessed memory, she tells the story, it's her story, saw her and recognized that she was not from that parish. She wasn't even Orthodox. And he called the altar boy over and opened the liturgy book and he said, "Go and give it to that woman." Well, the liturgy is going on. So she took the book and she followed. She said that was a discerning action. I want to learn more about this church and about the priest who took an interest in helping me understand where what this service was about.